This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we take presumably somebody's favourite movie, monster, creature, parasite, organism, tree, computer virus, break it down, see how they'd operate in the real world by looking at their ecology, so how they interact with the world around them, and their physiology. With me today is one half of Ecology for the Masses and the ecology side, Adam Harshak.
There you go. Perfect, yep, every time.
Like I said, fellow author on ecology for the masses PhD student at the University of Arkansas. And with me also is Dave, our veterinarian friend from Canada who looks at physiology. Not with us Canadian. Again today. Oh, yeah, the Canadian. Yeah,
the Canadian.
We managed to find one Canadian, Australian, and American joke back in the day, but yeah, we can't find that. Not with us again today is TJ, once again indisposed. He will join us at some point, hopefully.
I'm really thinking at this point we just keep him as one of these running jokes where we're like, TJ just doesn't get on the podcast. He becomes like Maris and Frasier, where you just like never see the character, but we always talk to it, and we're like, you know, TJ couldn't make it today, or like TJ's getting his nails done today.
Or like Jimmy Kimmel did with the whole Matt Damon thing.
Yeah, Matt Damon.
We didn't have time for Matt Damon, that whole thing.
Yeah.
I think TJ is actually down in South America right now at the running of the guinea pigs.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah. They've got to have a physiologist on by to inspect the droppings for signs of doping. Yeah. So that's where he's at right now. Yeah. He gets to travel, so you know, that's pretty good. Anyway, so we've got to start this week off on a bit of a fucking bad note. The National Museum in Brazil, in Rio, burnt down this week. Absolute fucking
tragedy. Tens of thousands of specimens.
Yep, completely destroyed.
Oh, gone. It was the largest natural history museum in... it wasn't specifically a natural history museum, but it was the largest of its kind in the whole of Latin America. And it's horrific. And, you know, there's actually blame to go around in this sort of situation. The thing had been falling into disrepair. Politicians had just kind of completely ignored it. It hadn't had any funds directed, or it had much less funding directed to it. It's one of the things that always happens when an economy's in trouble. Education, science goes on the chopping block. Yeah, so.
The good thing is one of the researchers in my department here in Arkansas is from Brazil originally. And he put up a status recently that they are already working to put together a new collection, like this, as of this week, they're already doing it.
There were some really touching shots of people carrying researchers and scientists running in and carrying specimens out of the flames and that sort of thing. Yeah. But anyway, how have you guys been? What's news?
Oh, just working on a meta-analysis and figuring out that I need to do a lot more work than I thought I did.
For those playing along at home, what's a meta-analysis?
A meta-analysis is a study of studies. So when a scientist does a study, usually it's one experiment. It's one experiment, and they have one set of one hypothesis or maybe a couple hypotheses. They want to try to test that, and it falls within the realm of some general question. Specifically, my stuff relates to parasitism. And when you have this with a lot of different studies, you want to try to figure out what the overall trend with parasitism is. You find all the studies you can that relate to that central subject, and then you put all that data together and try to find the sum of those effects. Basically, the one big effect for all those different studies. And after talk with my advisor, we think that my search terms might have been a little too narrow. And even though I thought I was coming towards the end of my literature search, I'm probably just beginning.
Well, for another... For those who haven't much experience with doing literature, literature reviews and that sort of thing, if you can find a meta-analysis of what you're studying, it is the holy fucking grail.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's just one paper where you can read the summation of everything you're looking for.
Exactly. So the only bad thing is it's a it's a shit ton of work trying to get all that together. The good thing, though, is this will probably be one of, if not my most highly cited paper that I ever put out.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Erik, varså snill lite stilla.
All right, Dave, what's up with you?
Basically, just the same in terms of work. It's just been crazy busy. Luckily, everything's starting to cool down a bit because we were getting a lot of heat stroke cases in during this summer when everything got like really, really warm.
What are the most susceptible animals to heat stroke?
It's just like during the day. And I mean, I guess we can use this as a good PSA for if you find you're outside and your dog is sort of breathing really, really heavily and it seems like their tongue is out and they're having a lot of trouble getting up, please get them either to a cool place inside of like an air-conditioned area or please get them to a vet because the problem is they can go into difficulties associated with like respiration and cardiovascular pretty quickly. And we've just been seeing a lot where owners were like, oh, you know, like we were just outside and we didn't think anything of it, or we were out all day at, you know, this certain event and we thought it was okay. And dunking them in the water is not going to necessarily fix everything, which you do.
You mean it doesn't work?
We do see a lot of people, and then you risk as well, like aspiration pneumonia, because you're dunking an animal that's like struggling to breathe in the water. And so they just, it's a big thing we talk about. If it's a really hot day, just take your dog inside, make sure that it's got lots of access to water, and make sure it's inside an air-conditioned space. But luckily, we're still super crazy busy, but we're not seeing a lot of heat stroke anymore, which is great.
Yeah.
Now you're seeing fall stroke. All those animals tripping on those leaves.
Yes, the big problem in the veterinary profession, all those leaf tripping dogs.
It's a dangerous time of year. Okay, so look, I'm just going to do I don't think this is going to get any better, so I'm just going to put a PSA at the start of this episode. I apologize for all the times my kid is screaming in the background. I'm doing the podcast. Normally, I would be taking care of him, or his mum would be taking care of him at this point, but she's off helping to feed the homeless, and I'm not joking. She is working at a homeless shelter to make food for them, so she can't do it at the moment, and I'm simultaneously taking care of him and doing the podcast.
So you're saying she's really selfish and putting her desires above yours.
Exactly. What's going on there? And last bit of news, we got a fucking logo this week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and who is the wonderful artist who made that for us?
My mate Patrick Duffy. So if you want to check his stuff out, and I really highly recommend it, go to Patrick Duffy Art, Duffy spelled D-U-T-H-I-E, on Facebook. He's also on Twitter. And all the Instagrams as well. Instagram's probably best for that, isn't it? Because, you know, he's an artist.
Yep. So.
But anyway, he's made a fantastic logo for us, which you guys will probably, anybody listening to this will have seen since episode one, since we're recording this on a bit of a time lag, but yeah.
If you're listening to this, you'll have seen the logo by now, and you'll have seen how amazing it is.
Yeah, bloody fantastic.
And think to yourself, which one of us is which monster? We do represent each one. Think about it. Yeah, so this week we're going over A Quiet Place, 2018's... one of the tentpole horror movies of the year, certified fresh and 90 on Rotten Tomatoes, 95%. Pretty generous rating for any kind of genre film.
Not as good as the original King Kong, though.
Apparently not, which is really weird, considering how shit that movie is.
98% on Rotten Tomatoes, that's bad boy.
But yeah, movie directed and starring John Krasinski, Jim from The Office, which is pretty surprising given his comedic background, but apparently he's a pretty big fan of the genre, and it shows in his execution of this movie. Mm. Yeah. So, general premise, humanity has been wiped out, and there are these monsters that hunt you based on your sound. So it's a very quiet movie. And yeah, I loved it. The only problem I had with the movie was when I saw it at the theater, which I hope everyone did, because it really cemented the atmosphere. I've never been in a theater where so many people have gotten up and come back in the theater over and over, and just the light shining in and people making noise, and I was going to strangle somebody. The movie was amazing, super tense, super quiet, loved it. But, oh my God, why were they getting up so much?
Yeah, this is the one movie you really do not want to fuck
up.
Breaking it.
So, Adam, you said that you'd read some of the stuff of what the movie is based on, some of like the writers and the...
Yeah, so John Krasinski, he did direct the movie, and he did modify the screenplay a little bit, but he didn't actually write the original screenplay. Mm-hmm. The original one was written by two gentlemen, and I will look them up right now who did it. But basically, they grew up in the Midwestern United States. And in that area, there are a lot of farms. And on those farms, there's a lot of, like the setting of the movie itself. They grew up in that kind of pastoral, rural, kind of isolated place. And let's see. Yeah, screenwriters Scott Beck and Brian Woods.
Okay.
So they grew up in this kind of farm-based area, and they thought, wouldn't it be interesting or wouldn't it be scary to have some kind of horror situation go down on a farm? You're in the middle of nowhere, you're all by yourself, and there's nothing around you that can help. Even in situations like in everyday life, you can have kind of an understanding of people in the country. I don't know if it's the same in Canada and Australia, but at least here, when you live in the country, you could hate your neighbor, but when they need help, you help them because you are an hour, 2 hours conservatively from town, from the nearest help.
Yeah.
And even if you don't like them, they might help you when you need help. So it's just a little bond you have.
Yeah.
And we can kind of see this in the movie where he puts up the light that one night, and you see the lights go on around them with other farmers in the area.
Like some other like interesting shit about this movie. I should say, normally we do the history of, you know,
the monster and where they've come
from. Yeah, yeah, but it's, I don't really have much to work with this week, so we'll just talk about the making of the movie.
It's a new property, which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's not a reboot, it's not a rehash, it's a completely new thing.
I'm no massive horror fan, because, you know, I'm a massive fucking scaredy cat. But over the last few years, it seems like there's been some really cool original concepts that have crept their way into the horror genre, and it's kind of gotten a bit better. Like, ever since, like, I think it was It Walks, and then we had Get Out, and...
It Follows.
It follows, yes. Yeah. It Follows, and then...
Get Out's more of a thriller than a horror, but it's still plenty scary.
Oh, it was really good.
And I really like this. One of the other things that was great about it, they had kids. Speaking.
Mm-hmm.
They had kids.
Well timed. They had kids.
At least
they were
quiet.
Yeah, real quiet kids. Yeah. No, they had a bunch of kids who weren't annoying. Like, I don't know if it's a recent thing, but child actors these days are a hell of a lot less annoying than they used to be.
Yeah, Stranger Things.
Some. The movies we're watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. True.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But the girl they got to play the daughter.
The deaf child.
She's actually a deaf actress as well.
Yeah.
And it added
a lot of credibility to the scenes, and apparently it added a lot of credibility to the sign language and making eye contact and everything like that.
Yeah, she was really big about teaching them slang.
Yeah.
Like, making sure that it looked natural, because theoretically they've been doing this since she was born.
Right.
So they should look like they've been doing this for a long time, even though none of them speak sign language.
Yeah.
Or no sign language.
And there's some brilliant scenes where, like, you see it from her point of view, like somebody's looking back at her and there's this look of horror on their face and she doesn't understand what's happening because she's deaf. So yeah, Dave, you take us through what John Krasinski's idea for this film was.
Sure. So obviously we don't cover in the film, and I really liked, I was listening to his interview and reading over sort of the transcript from it. And he said that he envisioned, and he said he understands that it's a terrible concept, but he liked the idea of wolves let loose in a daycare. And the fact that people are more interested in when, you know, the wolves are in the daycare than how the wolves got into the daycare. And so along those lines, he said that, you know, he still had built a big backstory and history with the writers and talked about sort of what they wanted these to be. And in his mind, he believed that they were absolutely aliens and sort of they'd come from a planet where, you know, they were the absolute apex predator. And they're not a thinking alien. And we see that throughout the film. They don't seem to have any, like, major plot about how they're going to, like, take over the world or any major ideas to, like, how they're going to do anything. They're just there eating. They're just eating and hunting. And, again...
Yeah, put that into context. Like, an apex being the absolute top of the food web.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have any other major competitors. Think of a tiger in the wild.
Right, and we have lots of examples of tigers getting loose, or what tigers did in Africa sort of during villages, or when the white South Africans sort of showed up and attempted to build major settlements in areas. When a tiger gets loose in an unfamiliar environment, it's not like the tiger does anything except hunt. It just.
I think you mean lions in Africa,
sorry,
right?
Sorry, lions.
This is the toss-up, though. Do I leave that in and, like, cut my bit out and make Dave look like a dumbass? Or do I just leave the whole thing in? How do I cut it? You'll never know. Uh-huh. Find out.
Never edit.
Weeks.
Never edit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he was talking about the concept that in his mind he sees that the quiets, because that's what we decided to call them for this podcast.
Silent boys.
their planet,
the Quiet Boys,
their planet had exploded, and they were trapped on basically the meteorites, the fragments, whatever it was, that eventually landed on Earth. And then that's how these aliens got basically shifted from their planet to our planet. And when they arrive, it's just absolute pandemonium. He makes it, and it isn't as clear watching over the film, but it's clear sort of in his discussion that they are invulnerable. They've evolved to be bulletproof. They are incredibly tough. And that's the whole reason why we aren't just wandering around shooting at these things, because it's not going to do anything. And
yeah. And it just draws attention to where you are.
Yeah. And they are only vulnerable when they open up, which, spoiler alert, you know, we know one of them gets killed at the very end when it opens up. The faceplates basically come apart. And at that point, they are vulnerable. We can get to the squishy bits at the center. But before that, they're basically nothing can kill them. So it doesn't make any point to take shots at them or try to do anything. And they're incredibly resilient, incredibly resistant, which is why we move into this lifestyle where basically we're just trying to survive day by day and work around them.
And yeah, like we said, it's just, I think we've kind of covered what we thought of the movie already, but it's just, it's really
it's amazing. Yeah.
Super good movie.
But the last 2 weeks, we've had a being that's on Earth or something similar to Earth in the case of last week to work with. This week, we've had, obviously, an alien. So with this, we haven't classified it into any one taxonomy from what we know on Earth, but we've worked with a bunch of different systems that we find on Earth, and we've assumed certain things that, you know, correspond to animals that exist on Earth. So... where we know they're an alien, but we have had to kind of work with Earthbound systems. So that's just a quick disclaimer before we let Dave take over with the physiology stuff. So
we're also having the advantage here in that the aliens are surviving on Earth. So we've got to assume that aspects of their biology, they're still able to build themselves and work themselves using whatever the resources they are finding on Earth. So as such, we're going to assume that they're probably applying by similar rules to what we have when it comes to physical arrangement, which allows us to sort of play and build them like what is seen on Earth to an extent, the best that we can.
Yeah. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light, I split the
night and touched the sound. All right, yeah, so Dave, take it away.
Sweet. So, as we decided, we're going to call these little guys the Quiets. And
Quiet Boys.
Quiet Boys. And trying to build their basic biology, I ended up sort of downloading a whole bunch of pictures of sort of what the artwork was supposed to look like and taking some screen caps from the movie, because obviously I had to do what I do every week, which is coming up with, you know, a basic idea of how big they are, what are they made of, how much do they weigh, that kind of thing. So to start with, as we do every week, I ended up using the scene where the Quiet is on top of the car as a way to try and measure out and figure out approximately how big are they. And it looks
a massive like, Chevy pickup.
Yeah, so if they're sitting on top of that Chevy pickup and I stretched them out, sort of if they were sort of stretched out from top to bottom, so not just the, you know, the head to the hips in terms of when they're in that curled position. If I stretch them out, they look to be approximately half the length of the truck, totally. So that places them, if I'm taking the model of the truck properly, at around 9 feet or 2.7 meters. So they're going to be big, and that looks to be about how big they are when they're in the room, when they're hunting the humans. They look like they're about 9 feet if I was to stretch them out. So that gives me sort of a size. Now, in terms of designing their like total mass, watching them kind of walk around, they look like bats if we were to take away the membranous tissue from the wings. They've got sort of the outstretched limbs. That's kind of how they walk along. It looks like they're walking like a bat does when it's walking along sort of the surface. So I wanted to sort of figure out and scale their mass up the same way that I do every week using the square cube law. And if I take a couple of common bat variant species, so I looked at the average common vampire bat. I also looked at, because of Sam and also because they're one of my favorite bat species, the ghost bat. Also because the ghost bat is going to fit a lot of our needs here in terms of they are an Australian predator bat. They do eat mice and sort of live creatures. They are endangered, so that gives me another sort of call out for this podcast. And they're just really cool looking. They're just one of the coolest looking bat species out there.
Is that why you were like, because of Sam, because like, I'm so cool looking? You were like, I found these really cool looking bats? Like,
because they're Australian? If you look at what they look like, they do look like you. I mean, it's basically a spitting resemblance in terms of these giant ears and this kind of weird nose and these kind of offset eyes. So like...
sharp, sharp fangy teeth.
Yeah. So, Sam!
That's me. That's me in a nutshell.
And so I ended up looking at like the common vampire bat, the average ghost bat. And I also just out of fun ended up... So the bats weigh in, the common vampire bat's around 30 grams. The average ghost bat weighs in around 150 grams. And for their size, our quiet is going to be between 22 and 30 times greater than either of these bat species. But I also, for fun, wanted to sort of take a giant animal that has some bulletproof capabilities, that has some very tough skin. I took a rhino, and I ended up scaling a rhino down, because rhinos weigh around 2,400 kilograms. And so I wanted to figure out approximately how big our quiet would be if I just use sort of a bat and rhinos as my examples. And they come in, if I do this and I apply square cube law, around 1,000 kilograms or 1 ton, which that makes sense. They're going to be about the same size as the Ents that we discussed last week in terms of weight. However, and we're going to get into this a little bit later, we think that that hard shell that's across them, the kind of material that seems to protect them, it kind of looks like a carapace, like an exoskeleton, something that's found like in crabs or other arthropods. Now, if I take an average crab and I scale them up to be approximately the same size as a quiet, they work out to about 6,000 kilograms. Now, I think that's going to be a little bit too heavy, because when we have the creature crawling across the truck, we see that it's not crushing the truck in. It's leaving dents as it goes across. But something that's sort of heavier, for example, the pressure that it takes to absolutely crush a car is around 2,300 PSI, or, you know, pounds per square inch. An elephant, when it's walking along in each foot, exerts between 75 and 100 PSI. So an elephant can theoretically...
That
is. Yeah, which is kind of cool. On the ground, that increases when obviously it's directing most of its weight onto a car. It's going to get up more into like the 200, 300, 400 range, which apparently is enough to start crushing in sections of the car. Which is why, like, an elephant walking across a car is going to crunch it down, but it's not going to completely obliterate it, crush it into nothingness, anything like that. So I think at the end of the day, I'm comfortable saying that our quiets probably weigh in around 1, maybe 2 tons sort of total weight, so 1,000 to 2,000 kilograms. Knowing that depending on how thick their shell is, they could get up to 6,000, but I don't think that's where they're going to be for this film. So they're about 9 feet, you know, between 1 and 2 tons in terms of their weight, probably closer to the 1 ton mark. And that totally fits with, they look in the film like they're reaching speeds around 50 kilometers an hour when they're booking it. So it's not like they're moving at incredible cheetah speeds or, you know, anything like that. They're moving at reasonable velocities. So that kind of sums that up. Now, just out of fun, I don't think that's going to be the big factor that we're worried about. I did end up working out their metabolic rate, like I do every week. And I just ended up using the ghost bat to do their metabolic rate, because I figured ghost bats are eating, they're carnivorous, they're eating mice, they're eating other like lizards and small animals like that. It's going to be the equivalent to what the quiet's eating. They walk like a quiet. They've got about the similar idea. Let's just use them as our model. And if I work that out, sort of the average ghost bat sort of per day needs about 13 sort of kilojoules per day to keep moving. And if I sort of scale that up using Klebler's law, like we've discussed in the past, I work out to a quiet that consumes around 4,600 kilocals per day. And that's just basal metabolic rate. We know these guys are really active, so I'm comfortable saying that that's going to double or maybe even triple. So they might be sort of closer to 10,000 kilocals per day, which is something.
Okay, that's not too bad.
It's not
bad.
How
much do we consume a day? How much are we supposed to consume? 2,000. Okay.
The average is 2.
Yeah.
And someone like Michael Phelps does about 9 to 11,000
exactly.
A day.
So I think the quiet can comfortably meet those demands, especially considering we see them eating everything. And they do seem to consume a lot of biomass. I'm comfortable saying that this isn't going to be their breaking point. They can definitely make these needs. Now, the one thing that I did need to try and solve was how are they going to survive space? I did a whole bunch of reading and went through, and I don't think that there's any way that our quiets can survive if their planet just blows up. Yeah. Their limbs are going to be torn off. They're far too big. However, if they lay eggs, which as we talked about, if we make them a little bit more similar, kind of a cross between a bat and a crustacean or an arthropod.
There are mammals that lay eggs.
Yes, yes. Sam is probably familiar with them because a lot of them live where he comes from, so...
There's only two of them.
They all live where I come from. No, there's three of them. There's two species of echidna.
Yeah.
One lives up in Papua New Guinea, though.
Yeah, but we have platypus, so suck it.
What do you mean you have platypus?
It's an egg-laying mammal.
It's in Australia and New Zealand, isn't it?
Yeah, what are you saying we?
Oh, I thought platypus had other regions. Okay, all right, so they're...
No, it's just Australia.
Okay, yeah, so Sam is familiar with all of them, then.
Have you heard of the Wallace line?
No.
So the Wallace line is this geographical line right through, the thing goes through the Philippines, Malaysia, and on one side of that, there's no marsupials apart from the opossum, which is marsupial, yeah. And then on the other side of it is every other type of marsupial in the world is on the other side of that line.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if we're gonna make them egg laying, I think this totally works. And if they lay their eggs and they take a little note from the brine shrimp. So
marsupials.
Brine shrimps end up having to survive in conditions where they're in incredibly high salt, the water does dry up, and once the water dries up, they're exposed to hardcore UV radiation. So
is that why they're called brine shrimps?
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought they're all called Brian. Like, you know. Just every one of them is just called Brian.
So,
that's where the name comes from.
Brian shrimp lay eggs that basically are encysted. They kind of wrap a double shell around them, and they completely dehydrate their eggs when they lay them. And this allows them, they just recently discovered accidentally while drilling or setting up a mine, a stock of eggs that they carbon dated to be around 10,000 years. And when they ended up adding those eggs to the water, the eggs ended up hatching, and although a number of them had congenital abnormalities and a number of them died, there was a fair good percentage that still produced normal, healthy offspring that have gone on to breed and are currently being studied by a few different laboratories. And that fits, because the nearest planet that sort of has an inhabitable solar system, if a planet was to explode and fragments of meteorites were to get flung towards Earth, I did some rough calculations and looked them up, and it would take around 54,000 years for that, and that's a pretty generous estimate, for them to arrive on Earth.
Very generous.
So anything that's going to be on these fragments of meteorites is going to have to survive for a while. Brine shrimp eggs might be able to do this. Now, brine shrimp eggs they're incredibly resistant. You can set them on fire, you can dissolve them in alcohol, you can deprive them of oxygen, you can zap them with UV light, you can boil them to temperatures up to 105. They can survive in absolute zero, pretty much to a point where like atoms stop moving. They can survive extreme pH, salt, insecticides, poison, incredible pressures, up to 6,000 meters or 20,000 feet sort of at the bottom of the ocean, they can survive it. These eggs are awesome. So I think that makes way more sense. I think that if our quiet sort of lay eggs, and you guys will get into this, if their planet is quite hostile, then they may have to lay these eggs, which are completely dehydrated because they can't have water in them. And then if they had a store of these eggs that were attached to these meteorites that then went sort of flying across the universe and ended up striking Earth and struck water, which we have a planet that's 70% water, then it makes sense that once these eggs were sort of exposed to water, then we'd have these immature quiets that would hatch, develop very quickly, and become the raccoon-killing monsters that we love and fear within the film.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the only way I think I can make them survive in space.
Yeah. It's interesting because this week I feel like there's not too many difficulties with their biology, how they function or anything. The main problem is getting them through space onto...
Yeah, that took... Well, and bulletproof, because a lot of people...
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So this was the other thing in terms of their skin. So a lot of people talk about this that, you know, there are bulletproof animals out there. And there really isn't anything as such as a bulletproof animal. There's bullet resistant... Yeah. And example, like the rhino has skin that can be up to 5 centimeters thick. and depending on where they take a bullet, it can glance off them, and so their plating can actually allow them. But at the same time, if they're hit with, you know, all of the weapons that we think the military might employ to sort of fire it at a quiet, if it showed up, 50 cal are going to be able to penetrate a rhino. They would be able to penetrate any of these
creatures. An elephant gun.
Yeah. So the other options for incredibly resistant skin in the animal kingdom range from pangolin plates are composed of keratin, the same sort of stuff that makes our hair or makes rhino horns. And keratin can be really resistant if you build it in the right way. We know a lot of crustaceans or like a lot of kongs, like shelled creatures, can build incredibly strong armor using limited resources. Or I found this incredibly cool species called the alligator gar. The alligator,
yeah.
They are so cool.
We have those.
They are so cool. And
they're scary.
Yeah, and they're actually, you can't slice through their scales with a knife. They're knife resistant.
They'll slice through you with their teeth, though.
Right, but you...
Yeah, you're looking that up, Sam? It's about 3 meters long. It will eat you.
They're so cool.
Sorry for those. I'm a freshwater ecologist, and I follow on Twitter a lot of people who study these alligator garfish, and they're constantly banging on about how cool they are. They are some real weird-looking boys.
Yeah. So there's...
They're prehistoric, too. They're an incredibly old family of fish.
Yeah, so the alligator gar, the way that they're able to build this is they actually have very, very thick scales that they end up sort of overlapping in this interesting pattern, similar to how you or I would build like scale armor to try and defend ourselves. Now, that being said, their armor can still be punctured by like direct pressure from like a bullet or a needle or anything like that. So I was rewatching the film and I was looking at the quiets. And on second sort of viewing, I think that they've got an exoskeleton. I think they've got something more similar to an arthropod, like a crab or anything like that. They seem to have this hard shell material. And I think that's the only thing that would allow them as well. We see that they only bend at certain points. They carry their claws like a praying mantis does, sort of bent up underneath them when they're sort of walking along. And when they're beating on the car, it doesn't look like the animal's getting hurt or anything like that. And it's the quiets are actually using their full forearms to bring down like force on top of the car to try and get in. And the only way that you would be able to do that is if you had some sort of hard armor substance that creates sort of a more stiff substance. And the other reason I ended up sort of justifying this is we know that the quiets breathe. We can hear them breathing in the film. However, we don't see their chest rising or falling. And that's much more consistent with what we see within animals like terrestrial crabs or other arthropods, where there is an internal respiratory system, but we don't actually get sort of the chest rising or the chest falling.
Okay.
So, sorry, Sam?
They do flex, though. I work with arthropods, and when I see... like my dragonflies, for example, their abdomens do flex constantly, like a human's chest.
Yeah, and I think that...
You can see them respirating.
Yeah, and that also has
with
more...
With the lifestyle, the life history that Adam and I have put forward, can that work with an exoskeleton?
Yeah. Yeah, it can.
Okay.
So I think the problem is it's just whatever their skin is going to be made of, there's no way that it's going to be able to resist a lot of these forces. Because at first I was thinking about trying to build them like a rhino or trying to build them like some of any of these other animals. But I think they'll actually work better, and especially because their claws seem to be so sharp that they go through sort of steel or they can completely cut through a human being, but seem to be completely connected to the rest of them. I think that if they've got some sort of hard substance that they secrete and maintain over top, that's going to give them the shell. It's also going to be what explains when the face comes apart, we see that there's muscles attached to those pieces of material over top. And if you or I has an exoskeleton, we actually end up attaching muscles directly to the exoskeleton itself and then manipulating that. I think they're still going to need bones and they're still going to need all the other structures that you guys are going to talk about. But I think that on the outside...
You have to, because you can't have an arthropod that large.
Yes.
It would collapse under its own
weight. But I think on...
Also, we're saying they have something of an endoskeleton and an exoskeleton.
Yeah, I think they have both.
Okay,
and I think they've got a traditional vascular, and we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go through, but I think the only way that they're going to be as resistant as they are, and they're also going to have these mechanisms for eggs and things like that, are if they have a hard exoskeleton to protect them.
Okay, right. I thought you were saying that they don't have bones.
No, I still think they need bones. I think they're going to be very complicated, but they still need bones.
Like we touched on earlier, there's not really an exact Earth parallel, but it's kind of a fusion of a couple of different organisms. On this planet, we have fish that have scales and an endoskeleton. You have the pangolin that has these scales on the outside and an endoskeleton. This is just more of the endoskeleton like we have, but an actual pure carapace like an arthropod, like a lobster or an insect has.
Yeah. So I was reading through. Anyways, the cool thing with the crabs is it turns out they actually do harden their claws to be about 3 to 4 times stronger than the rest of their body, which explains why our creatures are sort of reaching with their claws. And their shell actually tends to be more resistant and stronger when it's kept wet. To a certain degree, it strengthens the chitin, which is how they build everything, which explains why we see our quiet swimming, which is why they seem to be most happy, you know, eating other creatures. Potentially, they would be drinking. They're getting metabolic components. So I think that's what's keeping them flexible. I think that's why they need water to keep doing what they're doing, to a degree. So I think that's going to be the main way they're going to be able to be as tough as they are, and also how they're going to be able to open up their face, open up their shells, their material, is using an exoskeleton.
This is one of the situations where we can be like, they've evolved on an alien planet. They potentially have the like enzyme chains that allow them to build substances which are, you know, lighter and tougher than what we find on Earth.
So I think it's reasonable to say they could have come up with some armor that is dense enough and tough enough to make them survive while simultaneously keeping it light enough to keep them moving at the speeds they are.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yep.
So
yeah, great. I'm happy with that.
Yeah. Moving on to their musculoskeletal. As we talked about, I think that they're going to have two different muscle systems. I think that they are going to have an external muscle system that's going to allow them to open up the plates for their face and for their ears, and also to allow them to manipulate the armor kind of on top of the rest of their body. But I also think that they're going to have internal muscular structures attached to an internal endoskeleton as well, that is going to allow them to make these kind of movements. It's going to help them with the speed. It's going to increase their metabolic demands, but as we talked about, they're already incredible hunters. They just seem to eat whatever comes into their way. I think that metabolism is not going to be their big thing because they just eat whatever comes along. Now, in terms of their skeletal, we talked about this. So contrary to popular belief, bats don't actually have pneumatized bones like birds. They just have smaller, sort of more densely built bones that allows them to do more things. And I think that's going to fit better with you guys. Remember, pneumatized doesn't always mean weaker. It just oftentimes means thinner, which sometimes can translate to weaker. But oftentimes, pound, pneumatized bones actually can be stronger than what we see in mammalian bones, just based on how they're built or how sort of the calcium protein matrices are strung together. So I think that they're going to be fine having sort of exoskeleton like a crab, and then sort of internal skeleton. And as we discussed, the main reason they need an internal skeleton is they're too big. They can't rely just on an exoskeleton. They would collapse.
Yep. Okay.
And then sort of the last element, the really, really cool bit, I was rewatching the film, and they obviously don't seem to have any sense of smell, and they don't seem to have any eyes. They're completely working on sound to get around.
Yeah.
So I figured we would build them sort of more similar to a bat. And I was watching the film over, and they are definitely doing echolocation, which I hadn't caught the first time I watched the film. But on a couple more viewings, you can hear they go, ah, and then they go, taka, 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 and they make this like thrill that we're hearing. And we know that
if you could do that.
Anyways, we know that bats, that clicking noise that we hear from bats is just the only part of their echolocation, the noise that they're making that we can actually hear, but they're creating a whole range of sounds at different frequencies that are beyond our hearing. It also makes sense that if they're echolocating, that's why when they echolocate and the frequency gets bounced back by the cochlear implant that the girl has, why it seems to hurt them so much.
Yeah.
Because they seem to be getting themselves into a system like a resonance feedback system, where basically you're generating a sound, the sound is getting replayed, and it's creating this quite painful resonance that can cause you to vibrate at an uncomfortable frequency. And I think that's what's happening. And bats that I hadn't realized actually have a mechanism by which they give off this like high-pitched thrill or scream. And then at the same time, muscles inside their ear contract so they don't deafen themselves every time they make these noises. And then a couple of milliseconds after the sound has been produced, the ears relax so that they can hear the sound coming back. So I think that's why we see that they have that dense shell, and why when the sound is really uncomfortable, we see all the shell like collapses back down onto their head and they seem to try and block out all of the noise. So that's their mechanism. Yep. And even when they're walking around the house, we see that they make the noise and then the shell opens a little bit. And it's like they're listening to hear the noise that's coming back. Okay. And I think...
And I'm not sure if for these guys, I don't think we really get a good picture of it. Their ears seem to be symmetrical. But on an organism like an owl that also has really, really good hearing, their ears are actually on different heights on their head.
I'm not actually...
So they have three-dimensional hearing.
I don't think that their ears are symmetrical. So I was watching it last night. I think their ears are a little off-center. And as well, I think...
That would give them three-dimensional
hearing.
And
I think that's also why they open up their entire skull. And I hadn't realized the parts of the carapace that open up around the ears actually move. Similar to how, like, a rabbit or you and I actually alters our pinna. We sort of move the ear around to try and hear better in all directions. I think the whole reason they alter their skull is to create areas where they're concentrating sound from different directions to try and hear better in sort of 360 degrees. Now, I don't think that they're super accurate when they're up close because they seem to have a lot of trouble differentiating the humans. But I think that fits because if they're from a planet where potentially they were living in caves or something similar, they're going to be completely thrown off what their normal is and trying to differentiate what's prey and what's not, which is probably why they have trouble with the humans when they're up close, like in the barn with the mom when she's trying to move through the waterfall with the baby. And we see that the quiet's having a lot of trouble up close. It's making a clicking noise, but it's having some trouble distinguishing what she is. And I think it's just your frame of reference. They've only been there for a year and they're trying to like figure out like, okay, is this a human? Is this something that we can eat? Is this something that we want to go after? And so I think that they are doing echolocation. I think that's why it comes back, as they do have the ability to open up, hear from multiple directions, try to increase the surface area to concentrate and catch noise. I think the ears might be offset exactly as we discussed, like an owl, so they can sort of hear in a better area of direction. But I also think they have a lot of trouble hunting when they're up close, because remember, a bat hunts a moth because the moth is moving. And so the echolocation that's coming back, they can see that the moth is moving as they're echolocating. So the humans, I noticed when they're in close quarters, they don't tend to move that much. You're keeping yourself very still and you're doing short movements away from it. And in the humans that do seem to run, whether or not it's the pattering of the feet or it's anything else, they seem to be much better at going after. But I do think their frame of reference has thrown off as to what is food and what is not on their planet, because most likely whatever they were hunting has also evolved to be rather quiet on their world. But that's also why, so if the TV goes off or there's any major noise, they don't actually take any time to figure out what it is. They just smash it to bits, because they're still trying to figure out what's edible and what's not on this new world.
Right. And it seems to be dependent on their the footfalls, because we see the characters lay down sand every single day to make sure they're not making a lot of, you know, click-clopping sounds. Right. Although, with hearing that sensitive, they should be able to hear their heartbeats.
Ooh. Potentially, although your heartbeat is harder, despite what Daredevil has taught us, it's not a sound that you can easily like connect to and get to.
You mean the Marvel's documentary Daredevil, The Man Without Fear?
Yeah. So
it's a biopic.
Yeah, it is based on a true story.
Yeah.
So I'm not maybe, but it's also clear that their hearing isn't perfect because we see the raccoons, which means there is life, and the raccoons are not exactly being quiet. I mean, they're running down the street before one of them gets mucked, and they're being fairly noisy.
But they're also nocturnal.
They are.
And I think there's something to that with these guys.
Maybe. And you guys can talk about that. I do see them hunting during the day and the night, but I figured I'd leave that for you guys. The other thing that you guys are also going to have to talk about a little bit, and this is something we got into, is if they did arrive as eggs on Earth, their gestational growth period must be very short. But also, as we discussed, if they've been traveling for, you know, up to 54,000 years in space before they strike Earth, rememberhow we talked about with the brine shrimp, not all of the eggs were viable that landed on Earth, or sorry, that we tried to bring up of those that we found that have been stored for 10,000 years. Some of them had incredible congenital defects, and some of them just didn't hatch. They had been damaged. So there's only going to be a certain percentage that come off these meteorites that are actually going to be able to hatch to become viable. So depending on how dense you think their population is on Earth, we're going to have to talk about what their gestational period is going to be like and how quickly they're able to grow and reproduce. All right. So moving on then to the ecology segment.
It's no hassle. But I'm... All I'm saying... They're gonna get away... I'm just... Which... Knock, knock. Who's there? Look, let me tell you a little story about a man named...
Yeah, so, I gotta say, me and Anna, I had a lot of fun with this one. Like, this was really interesting.
This was real fun.
This was taking a new animal and kind of, as opposed to what we've done before, which is, you know, how could this work? We've been able to, like, essentially build a planet for it.
Yep.
Yeah, and all that sort of stuff.
So, at least an evolutionary history based off of what they look like and what it would have to have been.
Yeah. So we thought we'd start with the simplest thing, which was food, I guess, like what they're preying on, which in this case is fucking everything. I have some questions about certain species. This brings us into population density, which we'll go over later. If they're eating everything, their populations are going to be much higher and much more dense than they would be on their home planet. And there they've got, it's a fucking buffet. Earth is just a buffet for them right now.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that I was curious about. For instance, I thought with a species like this, you might have them stay away from smaller mammals because it's not necessarily worth their time. However, we see that raccoon gets smushed.
Yeah.
So they're all about going for the small ones. They're definitely meat eaters. Like you see, as Dave touched on before, you see those teeth. They're not being used for anything else apart from eating meat.
Yeah.
There are a couple of things like, so would they eat fish, for instance? Because fish are underwater all the time. I would think that would be potentially one selection of organisms that would be fine.
It would be, and those teeth would lend themselves to being able to, you know, hook onto and catch a wriggly, squirmy, quick organism like a fish.
Give it to us raw and wriggling.
Yeah. No, but I think that whilst they would be well suited in terms of the teeth for fish, I don't know if their hearing would allow them to...
Think of how bad it is when you get water in your ear, but imagine an organism that's entire existence is dependent on the ability for them to hear. If you get an ear infection, you're done.
Yeah. So I think with these things on Earth, you would see an enormous rise in bird populations and in fish populations. You'd see vast ecological changes all over Earth. I mean,
agricultural systems would plummet because if you so this would be touched on. We touched on it briefly, I believe, in the last episode, maybe not, but like tropic cascades. So when you have this, people think of like the food chain, a very linear thing, but it's not. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll talk about this in terms of a food chain, where you have your top predator, in this case, the quiets, and you have mid-level consumers below them that eat things as well, but they're also eaten by the organism above them. The very bottom, you have basal resources, and these are usually plants. And when you have plants, you're going to have organisms that eat the plants, and you have organisms that eat the organisms that eat the plants. And when the organisms that eat those organisms that eat plants get eaten, now the organisms that eat the plants, their populations are going to explode because they're not being predated anymore, and they're going to eat all the plants. The plants are going to crash. Then the organisms that eat the plants, they're going to crash too.
Yeah. So you see stuff like this all the time, images of New York 100 years after humans have died out and all the plants have grown back. It's going to be like that, but even more extreme because all the herbivores are going to be gone as well. You would get these incredibly, I think they would also be quite homogenous as well. Massive overgrowth everywhere.
Depends where you are, because at least in the US, we already have these huge monocultures that are bigger than a lot of European countries.
Yeah. Homogenization of ecosystems is one of the biggest problems that we're facing at the moment with the introduction of invasive species. Climate change is going to make it worse, and just like land use by humans is killing us there. But, yeah, anyway, sorry, away from that. We were thinking, I was thinking like, how big does something have to be before these guys won't go after it? However, regardless of the sound in a lot of these cases, unless it's a situation which, like Dave was talking about, whereby they're trying to figure out what's what yet, I would say that there's nothing on Earth that they can't take down. Like an elephant would be the big problem for them. But I mean, they go after the biggest sounds no matter how big.
It slides right through it.
The kid, when John Krasinski's character,
they roll down the hill to the house,
gets killed. The kids like trundle off in the car, right? Now, that's audible. That is, a car moving is audible, and it would be able to hear them. Yeah, so I would suggest that when they're feeding, they either stop listening because the crunching could be a thing, or maybe, I mean, when an animal's eating, they're the most vulnerable. Eating and peeing is like when you're at your most vulnerable. However, I would suggest that these things are strongly territorial and they know that when they're eating, they're safe.
And it's just a matter of the vibrations from eating itself, not even just the audible sounds of crunching.
So Adam's cut out. But if you want to get away from these motherfuckers, just sacrifice your younger sister. It's what I'd do. Sorry, Jess, if you're listening. But yeah, that brings us to like their evolutionary timeline, because as we've said, on their home planet, I don't think they'd have to work a lot harder for their meals, because you're going to have prey species that have evolved to defensive adaptations, whether that's just complete silence or an even harder carapace, denser bone structure, or that sort of thing. I would suggest that with a creature like that, it's going to be maybe they're very small. Like, you have incredibly small species that are able to hide. But the first hurdle we came across is, like Adam and I were saying, like, these things are pretty much all over the world, so they can withstand a great range of temperatures. So you need to have areas with heat on your planet. Now, we're no astronomers, but if you have a completely dark planet, that planet is probably going to be extremely cold.
Very cold.
Yeah. So we need them in complete darkness, because otherwise they would still have at least vestigial eyes. So vestigial eyes is when you have something that's left over. Like, kind of, I think the appendix is a vestigial organ. So, but they've got no eyes whatsoever. So they have been in constant darkness for a long, long time. So Adam and I said they're cave dwellers.
Yeah.
Which also, you know, fits in quite well with the kind of bat structure. We think they may have evolved from some sort of flying creature that ended up going underground and ended up just becoming bigger, because we said that the planet they're on has enormous underground caverns, which is where a lot of the advantages of echolocation would come from. Like we said, the limbs that they have look like a bat's, and they'd be great for climbing up rocks and that sort of thing. I mean, you see the way they move, like, it really lends itself to climbing up cliff faces and that sort of thing, or, you know, navigating caverns. And like I said, that really works well with the whole echolocation thing. This was the issue, though. Dave basically said to us, okay, we need a reason that they would need to hibernate. We need some sort of evolutionary adaptation that they built up on their planet, which would allow them to get through space. So we said that potentially what they retreated underground initially because you have a planet where you have extreme variation, like seasonal variation. And that might be something that's got potentially maybe a brighter sun, but it's still further away from the sun. So the years take a little bit longer. However, those periods can be quite where it's quite warm, and they need to desiccate or to dehydrate themselves, can go for quite long. And even underground, it's still quite warm under there. So that was our theory, that they're from a planet with enormous underground caverns, whereby you have quite extreme seasonality. It gets hot enough underground for them to need to desiccate their eggs to survive through particularly bad seasons. Yeah. Now, the carapace we originally thought might have something to do with protecting them from these sort of environments, because we know they're going to be the apex predator on their home planet. They're not going to need protection from other predators, but what they might need protection from is other members of their own species.
Or other predators, so even.
We think they're quite highly territorial. And so we think they'd constantly be patrolling their territory. They might be getting into scraps, and having that kind of that carapace is really a defense mechanism against other quiet creatures as well. Is that all we wanted to touch on with evolutionary history, Adam? Is there anything else we
need to maybe be able to touch about, kind of go into what it means to be for natural selection, because I think a lot of people have a common misconception of maybe a Lamarckian idea of evolution whereby you need a certain thing, so you evolve that certain thing. Like, some people have the idea that, like, with giraffes, they have long necks because they needed to be able to reach the taller branches, so the next ones had a longer neck, and the next one had a longer neck, and that's just not how it works. What happens is some individual is born a mutant, and its neck is longer, and it does better. So if that trait is heritable, its offspring also do better, and they are doing better than the ones with the shorter necks. The shorter necks die off, the longer necks live. So what might have happened with these guys is they look like bats. They might have been a much, much smaller organism before they went underground. They would have had wings, and some organism, maybe when they went underground to get away from the temperature, it evolved some kind of thicker skin somehow. And the one with thicker skin, it was better protected. It was able to win more fights, or it was less predated than the ones with normal skin. And so its offspring survived more. And over time, we're talking millions of years, the ones with thicker skin would have taken over. There wouldn't have been anyone left with the normal skin. And then because it causes them to weigh more, they can't fly anymore because it's too hard to fly a really, really heavy body. So once they start flying, then you could have what's called runaway selection, where there's no longer anything working against that harder skin. So it's just getting harder and harder. They're getting bigger and bigger. And eventually you get the massive quiet boy that we have today.
Yeah, the basic three rules are you need to have a mutation. That mutation needs to be advantageous. And that advantage needs to be heritable. So it needs to be able to be something that's passed on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that brings us to the next point, which is, so I work a lot in invasion ecology. I work with invasive species, that sort of thing. And this is a perfect example of what makes a great invader. You look at the cane toad in Australia, we introduced something that essentially had no natural predators whatsoever, and even if they did eat it, they'd die. This is a step above that, because there's nothing capable of killing it except for another one of these species. So you have a species introduced to a planet where it has no natural predators, and all the species that are there, with the exception, like we said, of fish and of birds to a certain extent, have no natural defenses against it. So it has just gone absolutely crazy. And what generally happens with an invasive species is it arrives, it establishes, it flourishes, it reaches its maximum distribution range, and then that range starts to constrict as its prey species start to develop defenses against it, or as it realizes its, you know, density dependence kicks in and there's too many of them, so they start to die off because they're competing too hard for resources, which we think is still yet to happen at this point. Adam has made mention of the fact that, like, these creatures would need a much larger home range than what we see, because, I mean, they've stated in the film there's three around this one farm.
Absolutely. It would have to have a much larger
range. And, like I said, I think it's just because they've come to this planet and they can eat fucking anything. So their populations have exploded. They're way above what a normal sustainable level would be. I would say you would see maybe 4 or 5 years after this, ranges constrict because perhaps they're establishing areas at the moment where they normally would not be able to survive, that are too cold or too hot for them. But because there's so much food, it doesn't matter. We've said that they are homeotherms, which means that they can regulate their own temperature by, you know, increasing their metabolic rate, which makes total sense. It's why they're all over the world. But like I said, I think you're going to see that distribution range constrict in maybe half a decade, maybe a decade. And potentially that would allow the human population to rebuild itself in some areas of the world if it survives long enough. So, yeah, we're a bit hopeful on this podcast this time around. But, yeah, I think populations would grow much smaller after a while. I think they've really hit a high point.
Another interesting thing that kind of related back to what Dave was saying about the resting eggs and how a lot of them are bad is because we're most likely only getting a small fragment of the population from the original blown up planet, you're going to have something called the founder effect, where because you had this huge normal, like this huge population on the original planet, it has all of its normal standing genetic variation, all of its good and bad traits. But because we're only getting a small subset, whatever subset of traits that small population had is going to be magnified in the population. So if this small subset of the population, let's say let's say there were 50 of them on the original rock, and 10 of them had a really, really bad recessive trait. That means that 20% of the offspring of these new guys are going to be having, at least 20% of this population, if it keeps expanding with that original kind of founder effect, is going to have really, really bad genes, and it's going to be bad in the long run. And this is what you have with like population bottlenecks, kind of. It's a similar type of thing where only a certain part of the population is left, and now because that population is probably going to have a greater percentage of bad alleles than the original population, that's going to be magnified in the future.
We should also at this point talk about, I mean, we've talked about the population exploding. That means that their life history is very short, because we know that the human population was almost wiped out after just 3 months, which is when the first kid gets killed. So they must have like, the eggs must have grown incredibly quickly. Again, that might have been accelerated because of the amount of available food they had on offer. Potentially they just started by eating insects and that sort of thing that they could get their hands on, and they just grew and grew. But regardless, these guys have a really, really quick growth, initial growth. I would say that they probably don't have very, very long lifespans because of the rate of their metabolism, the rate of their growth early on. And I would also say that the way they reproduce is, so there's a selection theory that was conceived in, I think, the 1970s, which is called R versus K. So it's like basically whether a species goes for one end of the scale, which is just have a shitload of babies, like ton of eggs. Most fish, most reptiles are like this, and then don't put much effort into caring for them. Or the other end of the scale is us, large mammals, whereby we have like one or two kids at a time, and we put a lot of effort into caring for them.
That also,
so it's either a, you know,
we also have to put that effort in because our offspring don't come out having any kind of motor ability or any kind of ability to fend for themselves. Whereby on the other end of the spectrum, you have an organism like a gazelle or a giraffe, where when they're born, they can go from the get-go. They're good to go because they've evolved to be incredibly mobile and capable from an early age because they're in a migratory group of organisms.
Okay, so the last thing we wanted to touch on was the fact that we see the one that we know about being fairly active during the nighttime. Like, he squishes that raccoon in the night. The main hunt, I guess, takes place at the night. I would suggest that they're probably less active at night, though.
I mean, yeah.
I think they're less active at night.
Because, they're obviously still listening. They're still drawn to that incident. They seem to have some method of, like, keeping a baseline of what's going on in the world around them. Yeah. And, I mean, if we assume that they're coming from a planet that they are living underground, they're some sort of cave dweller, then maybe they didn't have traditional sleeping behavior. Maybe they napped whenever they did and sort of put themselves into sort of a semi-vigilant state.
Yeah.
But they could, if they're on Earth for long enough, they might adapt to take on a day and night. It's just, we don't know if they even have any ability to detect, like worms, for example, actually do have some form of photoreceptor, even though they're blind, so they can detect sunlight. Yeah. We don't know if these guys would even have anything like that. There's no clear idea that they know the difference between day and night.
I would think that if they do develop nocturnalism, it's because their main, the time where they get the most food and they can find the most food varies between day and night, which is possible. I mean, the majority of your large kind of ungulates and, you know, smaller ones as well would be diurnal. So I would think that they would have more food.
In North America, They're meso consumers. They're smaller bodied, you know, mammals like raccoons, foxes, possums. Those are all going to be mainly nocturnal animals. So there is a bit of a trade off where you're probably going to see more of these smaller animals at night, but it's not as much resources to eat, not as much meat they're going to be able to get. But if they're hunting, you know, humans, deer, whatever, those are going to be mainly active during the day, and that's when they'd want to try to get them.
Yeah. They definitely could adapt something like that so that they are hunting during those hours. And as we discussed before, we're still not quite clear on, we assume that they've got to have some sort of active metabolism in terms of they're not ectotherms, they're having to generate their own heat. But depending on how closely related they are to something like a crustacean or a bat, it might make more sense to go into levels of decreased activity at night.
Yeah. Now, I would suggest
it would have to be something, a temperature cue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They might have thermal... I mean, I assume they have thermal sensitivity if they came from a very warm planet.
Yeah. No, I also think that they've that they'll probably, because of this sort of thing, they'll potentially evolve, like, longer lifespans. Because, A, I mean, they're going to have periods where they know they can go into, you know, some form of stasis, whether that's, you know, just straight-up sleep or decreased vigilance. But I would also think that that because of this, yeah, like, they'll develop longer lifespans just because they've got a larger food source. I mean, we're seeing this with animals in captivity. We'll tend to live for longer than animals in the wild because they've got, you know, their food handed to them, which these guys essentially will.
But these guys will still have competition of some kind.
True,
With the zoo, they're in complete isolation from any kind of selective force. Not necessarily selective force, but any kind of environmental pressure, any kind of negative impact on their life, their longevity period.
Yeah. Well, potentially that they'll go through a spike in like a longer lifespan initially, but then when that density dependence that we've been talking about levels out, perhaps that'll drop off.
Yeah. And as I've discussed a bit, I mean, their lifespan is going to be very much related to how quickly they're going to have to grow to take over the planet like they do. And also depending on the fact that, like, they are going to have to produce a lot to cover the globe, theoretically based on how little of them are actually going to survive the trip from their exploding planet to our Earth and be in a shape that they can actually be viable offspring.
Yeah.
Right.
Like I said, I think we've said already that they're going to be very quickly growing species. Like, they're probably going to have a lifespan max, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or something like that.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, I think we've already talked about this, but yeah, they just meet up to mate, and I think we've already hypothesized that it'll probably be just some sort of cloaca, like, you know, the way that frogs reproduce, where they just, you know, shoot a bunch of the various sexual gametes into a...
So, yeah, sperm and eggs, but so the female frog lays, she has her frog spawn. Well, she has it there, and the male directly fertilizes it. It's not a diffuse thing like you have with a lot of marine life, where they just kind of shoot all their gametes out in the water and they hope for the best.
Yeah.
For amphibians and reptiles, like it's a much more directed process.
Yeah, they basically, the jelly goes onto the toast kind of thing.
But I do think that's the least amount of time we've spent on the genitalia of these creatures in our first three podcasts. Anyway, although, I mean, the radiating scrotum wasn't exactly directly related to reproduction, was it? Oh, it was heat loss. Yeah. Okay, anyway, but yeah,
that's... if you want it to be.
That's our summary. In summary, I don't think we found too many problems this time around. I think the only real problem I have is that I don't think that these things would actually be able to conquer the planet.
No, the U.S. military...
You do or don't.
The U.S. military would have figured out this whole resonance frequency idea. They would have figured out sound waves against these monsters. And they're not going to be completely... Nothing is bulletproof. Nothing is completely resistant to...
The thing with that is it's not even to do with like the resonance frequency nonsense, the plot device. It's just we have weapons that will kill any organism. Right. It doesn't matter how big it is, how well protected it is. You launch a grenade at something like that, it's going to blow it up. Yeah. It's done.
If a shotgun blast can take out the head, then, I mean...
Theoretically, if you hit these things, like, you run over it with a tank, you're going to squish it, theoretically.
Yeah. You're going to fuck up that tank.
And the other thing is, like, you've got fucking helicopters. We never see these things having any capability of flight. And that we see a newspaper that has its sound as, like, the key written on it. Soon as that comes in, you think the military, right, well, I guess we just better test some bloody frequencies then.
Yeah.
As a disease ecologist, I think it'd be negligent of me not to bring up the fact that one of the things that might have been happening with the huge die-off on the plant is... Who knows what kind of diseases that these things brought with them that might have jumped species.
And actually...
It doesn't happen too often where you have diseases jumping species, and usually it's between pretty closely related animals, like you know, us and pigs or us and other primates. But they could be dying off because of who knows what kind of parasites and diseases they're picking up from our planet, or we could have caught something from them.
I think that it was fucking stupid having a kid.
It's incredibly stupid and incredibly irresponsible.
Could have been a response to the loss of their child, you know, maybe they just...
It could be, but it also goes completely against the characters that we know. They're very smart, they're very survival-oriented, they're very good at surviving and making taking these steps to be safe, but you're going to have a child. Unless you keep that child locked in that room for the first 7 years of its life, it's going to get killed. It's going to get you killed.
Yeah. Every day for 8 years, I have brought pepper spray into this office to protect myself and my fellow employees. And every day for 8 years, people have laughed at me. Well, who's laughing now?
Yeah, so who's come up with our verses this week?
Yes. So for the verses this week, in honor of the fact that, you know, we've got John Krasinski and his best known role from The Office, the discussion that I wanted to have was Dwight from The Office versus the monster from A Quiet Place.
Versus The Quiet Boys.
Yeah. Versus The Quiet Boys. I know we've given it in the past 2 weeks to, you know, to who we would consider, I guess, you know, the ring in. We gave it to Christopher Lee over The Ents, and we gave it to Alonzo Harris from Training Day over King Kong, but I don't see Dwight from The Office.
No. I think Dwight, and, you know, Dwight is one of those guys who definitely could talk himself up, and he could seem like he's got the quiets, but the thing is, one, he talks way too much. You can see him standing out there and being like, I've got, you know, weapons hidden all over the office. The quiets are going to, and then just gone. Yeah. But the idea that Adam and I were playing a little bit with was, if Dwight, being the nut that he is, has completely fortified his Dwight, you know, shrewd farms, and has, you know, got that entire place ready to go, completely stocked, and it is a small farm with all of these resources, did Jim just wait until Dwight got killed and then go sweet and then just move into Shroot Farms and be like, perfect, I got all this stuff, I got lots of resources, he's got all this like crazy survival gear, and all I had to wait was for Dwight to walk out there and be like, I've totally got this, and one of the quiets to wipe him out, and then just Jim Quiet Boy style shows up, moves into the house, and just goes on with his life.
I think Dwight, like, rock, you know, gets all kitted out and then goes and stands on his front lawn and does something he perceives to be really badass. Yes. Like, cocks a shotgun or something and, like, come and get me, fuckers. And then one of them does come for him and he craps himself and, dies.
Yes, yeah. So, unfortunately, I feel like Dwight versus the Quiets would be a very short, very definitive battle. I don't think we can give it to Dwight this week.
Yes, agreed. Yeah. All right, next week will be interesting because we're going to have a playoff between Alonzo Harris and Christopher Lee, and then a quiet boy and
Christopher Lee
and whoever we've got next week. Yeah, I mean, I don't think Christopher Lee's got that in the bag if he does go through. Well, we can talk about it next week anyway.
Fair enough.
But before we sign off, Dave, your turn to pick. What are we doing next week?
Ooh, okay. So I would really like to do the Graboid from the Tremors movie, from Tremors 1.
Great. Love that movie.
Yeah. So now, I know we've touched on this briefly. Are we doing just the Graboids? Are we doing the Graboids, the Shriekers,
and the Ants? I don't know. I can get
the full life cycle in there.
Yeah.
Just the Graboids.
Just the Graboid. Let's just do just Tremors 1. I know they extend on the physiology, but I think it's going to get too complicated if we try to do the Shriekers and try to do all the other creatures.
But we can do what we did with Kong, for instance. We're just using the first movie. But for supplementary information, we can, you know, look at the following six movies. Yeah.
There's that many?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's six movies, and then there was a pilot recently of a TV show which didn't get... it didn't get... They didn't order.
I thought it was already good.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Wasn't Kevin Bacon going to be involved
in the pilot? Kevin Bacon was involved. He's the main pilot character. But yeah, it didn't go through. Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, certainly does. All right, is there anything else we needed to do at this point?
I think that's good.
Yeah. All right.
I think to say that we can, you know, find us on the iTunes, Google Play.
Yep.
And as far as new podcasts go, I know people hear this a lot in podcasts, but honestly, 5-star reviews and some kind of review in the comments helps new podcasts out a lot.
Yeah.
Whole lot.
Where also you can contact us if you've got an animal you'd like us to do at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. We're now on Twitter at c.animalia. Adam and I are on Twitter as well. I'm at Sam Perrin, NTNU, SAMPERRIN. Adam is on Twitter at Hasik Adam, HASIKADAM. Dave is practicing veterinary medicine out of a caravan in East Ottawa. If you go onto one of the highways there and complain about a lost dog, I'm sure he'll turn up at some point.
Throw a rock off the highway with your note bound to it with an elastic band.
Anyway, thanks once again before we go to Patrick Duffy for putting together our logo. You can find him at patrickduffy.com. Thanks to Katie Heath for helping you come up with the name Cinematica Animalia. And thanks to everybody who helped us out by reviewing the first two episodes and giving us some feedback. It was really helpful. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, we'll see you next time for the Graboids from Tremors.
All right, see you guys.
Bye, guys.